Good morning, please be seated. First case on calendar this morning is Solomon versus State of Nevada. Counsel for the appellants wishes to reserve any time, please so state.
I have 2 minutes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Your Honor, Travis Aiken, on behalf of Solomon Holm, Brett Whipple is here as well. We're here on a case where Mr. Coleman was convicted of NRS 200.604, otherwise known as the video voyeurism statute. We have several points of contention. We believe the district court made several errors. The first error, we believe that he warranted either the police went outside the scope of the warrant, or if the court doesn't read it that way, we believe that the warrant was overbroad. Secondly, we believe that the joinder in this case was improper. Get into that later. We believe at some point the cross-admissibility exception for joinder was kind of rendered moot by the court in Reimer.
Well, we have also another case called Farmer. Have you read that Farmer versus State joinder case? It's just come out.
They were in the brief, Your Honor. Okay, Reimer. To jump to Reimer.
Okay.
Reimer basically eviscerates the clear and convincing evidence standard that is the whole justification that Zanis tells us. Zanis tells us that the defendant cannot be prejudiced if both acts would be admissible in another trial. And, you know, through Tinch or through Weber, you have a three-part test. The first part of the test is the relevancy, which we have a problem with, the motive. The second part of the test is the clear and convincing evidence standard. The third part of the test is the prejudice. Getting to the clear and convincing evidence standard, Reimer seems to tell us...
I think your time would... I don't mean to be discourteous at all, but I don't think re-arguing Reimer and the clear and convincing evidence test is as important, really, as focusing on the warrant issue and the statutory interpretation. Does this statute even apply to the conduct? In terms of what I personally am interested in, and I think my colleagues, it might help to focus on those issues more than re-arguing Reimer. I understand the issue with Reimer, but...
With that said, the issue as to sufficient evidence.
The sufficiency of the evidence. So essentially, this is a four-pronged test. One, that this was done knowingly and intelligently. Two, that an image was captured of a private area with another person. Three, without the consent of the other person. And four, under circumstances in which the other person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, that reasonable expectation of privacy over the four prong can be defined two ways. I think both sides have conceded that the first way isn't what we're talking about here, so really we're just left with the second definition, which is circumstances in which a reasonable person would believe that his or her private area would not be visible to the public, regardless of whether the person is in a public or private place. So going through the prongs, number two, capturing an image. I think there's a question of, can you capture an image or can you capture an image of an image? It's not defined. Later, NRS 200.780, which is a dissemination of an intimate image, is kind of the revenge pornography statute. I think this case would fall more into that, but that statute was enacted in 2015 and wouldn't apply to this case. The legislature went into great lengths to defining what an intimate image was, circling back around to this case. If someone captures an image of an image, is that unlawful under the statute?
Yeah, I think that is the main issue we're concerned about while we're arguing, just as Pickering pointed out. I have some grave concerns that statute applies to this alleged conduct, so I'm going to be interested in what Ms. Lucich says, if that is the only thing they could charge there, because can you capture an image of an image, you know, like that. So you let us know what you think about that.
And I think the consent issue is important here. She gave blanket consent. And blanket consent is every form of consent you can imagine. To draw a hypothetical, if I go to a pawn shop and I buy a phone, okay, and I'm assuming that I've got consent to access anything on that phone. If I record an image of an image on that phone, I think under the facts of how Mr. Coleman was convicted, I think that I would have criminal liability if I were to record an image of an image on a phone that I found. She gave blanket consent. Blanket consent. I'd like, you know, I hope that your honors would look at the appendix.
Why would you say she gave blanket consent? I don't think it was initially phased that way.
Well, if you look in the appendix, under, you know, her testimony was that she gave blanket consent. That's in the appendix on page 585 through about 590.
To viewing the image on the phone, not to the moment when the image was captured originally. She handed the phone over and said, look at it, it's fine.
And she denied that she even knew those images were on the phone. So it's hard to think that she would have an expectation of privacy of something that she didn't even know existed. And if you give law enforcement access to your phone, there are many reasons why Mr. Coleman might have recorded that video. Number one would be to investigate her possibly breaking the statute. Number two, they found drugs in her purse, and so he's investigating for drug activity. And an inference could be made that if the alleged victim in this case was involved in drug activity, her boyfriend might be involved.
Well, what's it have to do with recording this video on his phone? I mean, that has nothing to do with the criminal investigation. That's just kind of a voyeurism.
First of all, he could have been investigating her committing the exact crime that he was convicted of committing. Second of all, if she's involved with drugs, then her boyfriend could be involved with drugs. He could have been reporting to try to assess the identity of the boyfriend. Third of all, Pillow Talk might have initiated some sort of criminal information that Mr. Coleman could have followed up.
We're looking at how Mr. Coleman's conduct either falls within or falls outside the statute that we have in front of us. There's some overplay as to the individual, the owner of the phone, but the real concern is that conduct. Also, the concern is as to the counterpart, if that tells us anything, either for you or against you, from the federal statute that's very similar to this statute.
Well, I think the federal statute, and then in the reply brief, we put in some legislative history from the state statute, was basically to stop upskirting and to stop people from putting cameras in dressing rooms, in hotel rooms, in vacation rentals. And in all of these cases, there's a physical nexus between the recording and the person. Here, we're one step removed. We're taking a recording of a recording.
On an instrument that was handed over. So taking the statute by its terms, which a criminal statute has to give fair warning of the conduct that's being criminalized. If you look at 1A, your point is there's consent because she handed the phone over for him to look at it. But secondly, the reasonable expectation of privacy prong is a defined term. And it's not one where she's disrobing in privacy. So under E, one doesn't apply. So I guess the question is whether E2 applies?
Yeah, so when somebody hands over their phone to the police, denies ownership, gives blanket consent, she doesn't have any kind of reasonable expectation of privacy that her phone would, that the images would not be visible to the public. She's basically given over the phone for someone to look at and someone could see those images. Furthermore, she denied that she even knew that those images were on there.
So how does that help your case?
Well, so how could a reasonable person believe that his or her private area would not be visible to the public when they didn't even know that an image of their private area was even on the phone and even accessible? How could they have an affirmative belief as to an expectation of privacy in that instance?
Yeah, I'm struggling to make this statute apply. I mean, I understand that that's on your side of the case. So.
Yeah, and at the time the original video was recorded, of course she didn't have any expectation that the images wouldn't be captured. She was captured.
Right, but the offense charged is not the original capture, but whether, I mean, the legal issue we have to decide and write an opinion about in order is, did your client capture an image by recording on his phone a video of the video recorded on her phone? And was it criminally chargeable under this statute?
And I believe if you can read it that way, then the statute is vague. It fails to provide sufficient notice to enable persons of ordinary intelligence to understand the conduct that is prohibited. And it lacks specific standards, thereby encouraging, authorizing, and reason failing to prevent arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. And Olson gives us guidance here, right? The officer in Olson, he was accused of civilly violating the Fourth Amendment rights of the person that had sent an email. And in that case, the state declined to prosecute. The state dropped the charges. And so what we have here is the state enforcing the statute against Mr. Coleman under facts that don't seem nearly as egregious as the facts of Olson.
Right. Olson's kind of a two-edged sword for you, though, because they at least acknowledge theoretically the statute could apply. I mean,
well, that a finding of a reasonable police officer can make a mistake of law at that point.
Yeah.
But that more goes to probable cause. That doesn't go to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And discriminatory enforcement. Mr. Olson was not charged. The case was dismissed. Mr. Coleman was charged and convicted. Well, this goes to the whole purpose of why we do not allow vague statutes.
Do you invoke the rule of lenity on it?
I had not considered that, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you may save your time if you wish.
Sure.
Ms. Lucich.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Lisa Lucich. I represent the state of Nevada. And I suggest to you that NRS 200.604 is clear on its face. What it tells us is that a person cannot intentionally, knowingly capture the image of the private area of another. The statute goes on to define all of these things. And when it defines capture in section 8B, it says capture with respect to an image, videotape, photograph, film, which is the things that we normally think about. But it also says record by any means. And record by any means means he can't take his phone and record what's on her phone. The Olson decision is quite good for us, I would suggest, for guidance, because what Olson said was that a person does have a reasonable expectation of privacy in nude photos on her phone. So when she put these nude photos on her phone, that is when her reasonable expectation of privacy began. She doesn't lose that reasonable expectation of privacy just because she didn't remember that they were on the phone. But also remember, Justices, that her phone wasn't active. She couldn't have made calls or texts with it. So she couldn't have sent those pictures anywhere. And it's not like those photos, videos, or whatever were her screenshot. You know, if it was the screensaver, then you could say maybe she no longer has a reasonable expectation of privacy. But they're in the phone. Defense counsel suggests that, first of all, she had drugs in her purse. She absolutely positively did not. Brittany, her friend, had drugs in her purse. Lauren was 7 months pregnant. She was not under the influence, as reported by the officers. There were no drugs in her purse. She was not charged with any drug offense. She was merely arrested on warrants that, the record reflects, were not even drug-related in nature. So when he asked for her phone, he really had no reason, legitimate reason, to ask for her phone. And the testimony that came out was he repeatedly asked for her phone, and that's why she handed it to him. She testified that she believed that he was looking for evidence of drug transactions or something like that, and she knew there was no evidence of drug transactions or anything like that in her phone, which is why she gave it to him. So she may have consented for him to look through her phone, but she never consented for him to take, to capture that video, to record that video. He basically stole that video from her, and she never denied ownership of that phone, ever.
Does this, the factual situation here, does it really fit this statute, or whether it was really a dissemination?
I mean, he disseminated it to himself, but it does fit the statute because what he did was, while he captured the image of an image, he was still ultimately capturing the image of her naked genitals. Her naked genitals ended up on his phone. So that's what he was capturing. That's the only way he was able to do it, because he couldn't send it from her phone to his, because her phone was not active.
What do you do with the fact that the statute requires that this, let's credit your argument for the sake of this discussion, and I'm not sanguine about that either, but let's say that videoing a video of somebody who's naked is actionable under this statute. But to get there, you have to say that the taking the video of the video was without the consent of the other person. My understanding of the facts is she handed him her phone and saw him video the video.
No, he videoed the video while he was sitting inside the police car. She was sitting outside the police car on the sidewalk in handcuffs with her friend.
What do you do with her testimony? It was a blanket consent, and she left the phone with the police. She didn't care about it. She didn't want it. It showed up a year later.
Well, I disagree respectfully. When a police officer says, give me your phone, you give him your phone.
Well, but she consented. He didn't have a warrant for that phone.
Well,
she gave it to
I
him.
Know that, but generally when police officers say, give me your phone. Now, could she have said no? You and I absolutely know that. Did she know that? Who knows? But she gave it to him to look through. She never gave him consent to take anything from her phone, to take those videos.
She gave him the phone and never asked for it back, and he didn't have a warrant to seize it.
She's also a 7-month pregnant young girl. Does she know that she has the right to ask for it back right then and there? And by the time she was in jail...
Right, but the law has to treat that as a consensual delivery of the phone. How else can we treat that? You're saying there's two different forms of consent? I mean, if you were here and she were arguing against you that the police improperly took her phone and looked at it, you would be saying, no, she consented when she handed it over to them without objection and said, have at it, guys.
I agree that she consented to him looking through her phone. She did not consent to him stealing, capturing the videos of her having sex with her daughter's father. And he did not have a warrant to do that either. So he had no right to,
Let's go to B, under circumstances in which the other person has a reasonable expectation of privacy, and then how that gets defined under 8E of this statute. And how that, walk me through textually how we would support video of a video applying here.
Well, because he doesn't have the right to capture it. Capture is defined as recording by any means. It doesn't, because it gives
right.
you
I'm,
some
I'm,
examples, the videotape, the photograph, the film, which is what we normally think, but it also says record by any means, and that's what he did. He recorded with his phone what was on her phone. He recorded it by any means. So it does fit under that section
no,
of the statute.
I'm sorry, you must have misheard me. I was asking you to address 8E as an elephant.
Under circumstances in which she had a reasonable expectation of privacy,
yes.
Subsection 2, where she believes that her private area is not going to be visible to the public. It's in her phone. The only way you can get to it is if you take her phone, you open up her phone, and you look through it, which is when I...
But she handed the phone to him. So at that point, it's... I mean, we were arguing about this with consent a moment ago, but the same discussion applies to E2 in my mind. If I hand you my phone and it's not password protected and you're free to look at it, does E2 apply here?
Well, yes, I still think it does. Because as it sat in her phone, it was not visible to the public. When she gave consent, it's still not visible to the public. It's just that the phone is visible to him himself.
Right, but he's a member of the public for purposes of this statute, right?
Yes.
It's hard. It's a tough call to apply this statute to these facts.
She has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the phone. Olson tells us that.
Right, but if I give you my phone and I say, here's my password, or it's not password, you just need to slide it if you want to look in it. What expectation of privacy do I have when I do that?
So you're suggesting that she's waived her expectation of privacy by handing him the phone?
Not even waived it. Just, I mean, it's not quite a waiver for all purposes, but it sure as heck, I have trouble saying that's consistent with proof beyond a reasonable doubt that she had a reasonable expectation, that she exhibited a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to what was on that phone.
But I think that the consent is different.
I do too, but I'm focusing on E2 right now.
Right, but I don't think that...
I see a point on the consent, but E2 is a problem for you.
The consent under the subsection that it's committed without her consent... I mean, she's not consenting to him taking it. So the fact that she consents to him looking through it doesn't mean that she's waived her expectation of privacy. She still has the expectation that nobody is going to... Like, he sees it and should go past it. He shouldn't take it and keep it.
Right, but under E2, you're saying that I'm just making the same point over and over again. E2, she doesn't exhibit a reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the images on that phone by giving it to somebody to scroll through. Whether or not she gave him permission to record it later. Like, I'll give you capture and I'll give you limited consent, but I'm still struggling with reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis those images if she hands it over and says, look, you know, have at it.
She had indicated that she forgot that it was there. I don't think that because she forgot that she's there, she loses her expectation of privacy.
I don't know. I mean, if you forget to wear a skirt and underpants, it's kind of, you know.
I get the only other thing, Mrs. Jai, and I understand your argument.
I do.
Wrestling with it, too, obviously, why we're here today. But was this argued to the jury? Is it your position this is an issue of fact for the jury to determine?
Yes, it was argued to the jury. And yes, I do agree that it's a fact for the jury to determine. We argued all of these subsections to the jury, and the jury found that it was. You know, obviously you can have a different opinion, but as I indicated, I don't think that just because she forgot that it's there that she has lost her reasonable expectation of privacy. It's obtained or when it's placed on the phone.
I see your point. It's just fitting the statute to it. Could you comment for me? I was also interested in the issue with respect to the search warrant, and I understand the three paragraphs, the first and the third being very date specific, the second not so much, and how you say, therefore, the police were okay to go back a year to find this, and then it yields the phone. The question I have, though, they raised the point that the probable cause to look in the phone is contextually what authorized the search warrant, and that probable cause was tied to those two dates. And so that was intriguing to me that you would read, why wouldn't you read subparagraph 2 of that warrant once they knew whose phone it was? Why was the search authorized? Why was there probable cause to search the entire phone from the time of its inception to the time of the search? Well, why should we construe a warrant like that when I'm struggling to see the probable cause for paragraph 2 that way?
Well, paragraph 2, you mean any data or files that tend to establish the identity of the persons in control of the phone? Because phones are so mobile these days. I hand my phone to my kids all the time, and they do things on my phone. So we need to demonstrate who is in control of the phone.
But the focus was quite precisely on the other alleged victim as to whom the charges were. The jury returned an acquittal. Initial B, I don't want to say the name, but the search warrant was entirely for B, right? And the dates associated with B.
But we still, when we prove our case to the jury, we need to prove who is in control of the phone, and that's why they look through to see who exercises ownership and control of the phone.
So, for at any point in time, or at the point in time where the photographs of B on the bed were taken, allegedly?
Well, who obtained the phone from the beginning?
I mean, would it matter who had the phone on other days other than the date when the alleged dirty pictures were taken?
Well, I mean, in theory, it could. Like I said, when I give my phone to my kids and they put stuff on it, is that going to be attributed to me in the future?
Oh, I see your point.
On my phone?
I see your point.
And my kids do stupid things on my phones all the time, so that would be attributed to me otherwise.
So anticipating a defense that I didn't do it, some other dude did it, kind of?
Which is something that we always have to do,
yes.
Because we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury that not only was it done, but it was him who did it. I see my time is up.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Justices. We would ask the court to uphold the conviction.
Counsel, your rebuttal.
And Mr. I'm interested in the argument that all this was presented to the jury. There's issues of fact here. The jury concluded your client was guilty. Why shouldn't we defer to the jury on it?
I think because the statute, if that's the way the court decides, then I think the statute is vague. When we're talking about 82, the state seems to say that here an expectation of privacy that no one would record the video. Okay, that's not what 82 says, is that her private area would not be visible to the public. The state says that the woman in this case, she was young, she was pregnant, she didn't know what her consent meant. It's not subjective definition of consent. It's which a reasonable person would believe that his or her private area would not be visible to the public. And I'm assuming that this is what happened at the district court, that there was blurring and that the state used the vagueness of the statute. And it seems your honors are grappling with the complexity of the issue, and it's hard to think that jurors could grapple with this issue without some sort of guidance from the court.
Well, from time to time, we have not been seen as reasonable persons. So we're asking the interpretation of the reasonable persons who sit in that jury box what they might in fact think of this particular statute.
I go back to the pawn shop hypothetical. Blanket consent is blanket consent. How is it any different than if I buy a phone, and regardless of whoever recorded a video on that before, whether they know or don't know that there's pornographic images on the phone? If I buy a phone, I have consent to access that phone, and I record it. under the terms of what we're saying here, and what we're saying, a reasonable jury could find me guilty of a crime.
Well, I think Ms. Lucich is saying that even if she consented for the officer to look at the phone, and she didn't consent to having this stuff recorded, you know, and therefore it's a violation of statute. What's your response to that?
That it's blanket consent, and I believe that a reasonable person, I sure as heck know if I give my phone to the police, they're going to look through everything.
But there's a limit on consent. You know, the reverse, if you're a criminal defendant, you can consent to maybe search your car, but you know you can't necessarily take the dashboard out and look for drugs in there. We have cases like that. I mean, there's a line you draw there. So where do you draw it in this case?
Well, when she testified that she gave him blanket consent, I feel like blanket consent means blanket consent. This isn't like Olson, where she gave specific consent. This is blanket consent. And just to touch on the search warrant issue just for a second.
But you talked about the consent. Consent was, she gave the phone, was a consent to record whatever was on it? What was the consent?
It was blanket consent, Your Honor.
Well, I understand the term blanket, but the consent was they asked for the phone, here, take the phone. Didn't say, you're correct and limited, but didn't say, you're free to photograph or video whatever's on my phone.
And if there were evidence of drugs in there, would the police be free to photograph or take evidence from it? I mean, when you give a police officer your phone, you deny ownership, you give them blanket consent, they're going to look for
so
your
do
phone.
You think the police could put these pictures on the internet?
I think that as of 2015, that we have the revenge pornography statute, NRS.
Right, but under this, let's pretend we don't have that statute yet. Do you think that that consent carries the day for that?
Well, I mean, that's really not implicated in this statute.
Yeah.
I would say before the revenge pornography statute, then yes. I would say after, and that's one of the reasons why the revenge pornography statute was enacted.
Give us your closing thought, counsel.
I just want to circle back over the warrant. He admitted that he owned the phone. The police had taken the phone from him. Paragraphs 1 and 3 clearly implicate just 2-day time period. Going back in year time does nothing to show ownership of the phone during these days. Okay.
But what about her argument that he could have a defense that other people were putting stuff on his phone? That other people have exercised control over that phone?
Well, I can understand that argument if it happened, on these dates or after these dates, but not a year prior to these dates. A year prior to these dates is a fishing expedition. And I would end with, if we're going to allow this warrant to stand, then all warrants in the future might as well just say the phone. They might as well just say the phone. I mean, what's the point of putting any kind of particularity, any kind of specificity, if we're going to allow that reason, then we might as well not even write up these big long search warrants. Might as well just say the phone. And I'll end on that.
We thank counsel for the arguments this day. This matter is